Pleasure to be here. I'm from Calgary, Alberta. I trained in California. Canadians in a bunch here. I'm glad to be here for a number of reasons, because I trained at Stanford, and it's really nice to be back in the warm air because it snowed twice in Calgary already. So I'm glad to be here, and it's a pleasure. That's amazing stuff that Dr. Stewart just showed, and I'm a pediatric ophthalmologist, as he mentioned. Suffice it to say that what I'm going to show you is new stuff, old stuff. It's very affordable. It's been around for a long time. Pediatric ophthalmologists tend to be a very conservative group, and it's difficult to change. It's almost generational. So some of the stuff that I'm going to show you is still considered heresy in a number of groups of my colleagues. And I think the first thing I can say, sorry, I have to come over here because I'm using these cue cards, but I could start this by a quote from Mark Twain, who was a pure genius. He said, it ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you knew for sure that just ain't so. So hopefully you'll keep an open mind on what I'm going to say and not shoot at me like a number of my colleagues have over the years. So a lot of problems we get into in pediatrics relate to amblyopic issues, and traditional methods of treatment may just not be successful, like glasses, contact lenses, patching, and atropine. But the vast majority of kids, they'll improve. But what about the ones that don't? A lot of children, and you can read the list there, have underlying medical conditions associated with their high refractive errors and amblyopia, and they just won't wear glasses, bottom line. They may be averse to wearing them, having any facial appliance on their head. Kids with CVI problems, that's very true. Their motor control disorders can cause chronic viewing around the edges of the glasses, and contact lenses half the time, or more than that, are a non-go. So this uncorrected ametropia exacerbates their neurobehavior disorders, and the child then is living in constant blur. They're functionally blind, and they have a reduced interest in the outside world and social situations. And you probably hear this all the time, and well, that's as good as we're going to get. But the good news is that there are some potential options now. Now, everybody in the room is probably aware of these laser treatments, and we'll just go through a few just very briefly for those that don't. But now, in the literature, all of these techniques have been used in children in one way or another. There's a plethora of research now that shows that. So PRK, briefly then, is it's the old way, you take the epithelium off, you buzz the entire stroma for how much you need, and then allow it to heal. The difficulty is that it's more painful, and they tend to develop a little bit of haze, but that's been dealt. LASIK, I'll tell you about LASIK in a sec, but LASIK, they cut the stroma and then lift the flap up and laser. The problem is you've only got half the thickness of the cornea, and it was a procedure to get busy professionals back to work quickly with minimal discomfort. And it works. There's been a number of papers that show in children that when LASIK works, it works great. The problem is there are some potential issues with that. And there's a cut in the cornea. As a result, LASIK came into vogue from this doctor in Italy that you see there, Dr. Camlin, and it's been a number of different names there that you can see that have been used in the literature, but it's basically now called LASIK, which is kind of bad nomenclature because people get LASIK and LASIK mixed up. The difference is that instead of cutting the stroma, the epithelium is lifted off either mechanically or with an alcohol solution. And the laser is applied, and the epithelium is put back down, and usually a bandage contact lens. That's what I was trying to show you in the video that didn't work. And the beauty of that is it's a nice combination of the old PRK and the LASIK way with minimal discomfort. And if you add mitomycin to the mix, the haze problem that PRK can cause is virtually eliminated. So there's been major improvements. Now, in children, we're not going to get their cooperation, especially kids with all those neurobehavioral problems. So we put them to sleep. There's been reports that that's a major issue. In reality, I don't think that's a problem. It's standard anesthesia delivered in a standard way, either the laryngeal mask you see there or a tube through the nose and nasopharyngeal airway. And in this situation, we use it more like in an operating type situation. That's been a problem for people that are trying to use this technique because it's difficult to get approval sometimes to do laser off-site. Okay, so let's cut to the chase. So here's an example from a paper a few years ago from some of our literature that this is all kids with an isometropic amblyopia, big difference in refractive error. These were the kids that weren't getting better. once it got better, we left alone. And you can see here that in all patients, in this paper it represented 55 kids, and the mean difference between the two eyes pre-laser was close to 5 diopters. So that's enough to induce significant amblyopia. And in the myopes, 9 diopters of difference, laser down to 1.18. In the farsighted kids, 5.8, 4 diopters, close to 6 diopters of difference between the two eyes, laser down to 0.94. In all patients, 4.77 down to 0.56. So now you can see that they're all in a range where potentially now the eyes are close enough in power that then traditional treatments will now work. So that's the advantage of the laser. Well, did it work? Well, close to 63.6% of the kids all had visual improvement post-laser. These were kids that were absolutely stuck and not improving. No child lost any vision. You can see that pre-LASIK, there was about close to 40% had some form of stereopsis, and it improved to close to 90%. So they're seeing better and they're fusing better. So here's an example of a child. This picture is post-laser. You can see this bizarre situation. Huge amount of myopia, huge amount of astigmatism in the affected left eye. And we lasered for minus 13 instead of minus 12, so we're targeting plus 1. And his vision came up to 20/25 with treatment afterwards, and that kind of post-op refraction. This is a child, the opposite end, it's farsighted. So the amblyopic eye is plus 7.25. 6 months of patching, 6 months of atropine with absolutely no response. And by 2011, post-laser, you can see that he's nicely balanced. His vision was still down, did improve significantly. And corneal surgeons in the adult group, they worry when the corneal thickness is less than 250 microns, because that's when you can get ectasia, weakness of the cornea. And you can see just the measurements there that we're not even close to that danger zone in this child. This is an extreme that I show all the time. And the adult guys, you can see them in the audience think, well, you can't do that. But I'll show you that you actually can. This was a child that was labeled at 6 months of age as extremely developmentally delayed. And he had congenital high myopia of about minus 25. And now he's about minus, he would have been minus 31. So we lasered for 17.5, and I think you get more bang for the buck because the eyes are soft in children. And just like the same concept with hydrocephalus. And we got 23 diopters of effect. So at 1 year post-laser, he was now minus 3, but in a normal range, so he could wear glasses. And he ended up, he's now about 18 years old, and around minus 6, but he's functioning in normal school, he's got a driver's license, and he's doing very well. Well, the adult guys will say, well, are you out of your mind? You can't laser that high. But here he is at age 13, and he's been minus 6 even till 18, but you can see his corneal thickness there in the center is like 506 or 508 there. And the other eye, 501, I think it says. And, but again, it's not in that 250 danger zone. So I think what happens in these younger kids, the cornea is thicker and you get away with murder. So it's a totally different issue than in adults. Like in adults, that might induce ectasia, but in children, you get away with it. Now, let's flip quickly to femtosecond lasers. There's a technique that some of you will have heard about called a relax technique or the smile technique. Smile means what it says, small incision lenticule extraction. So you're making the laser makes a small cut, but the lenticule is lasered out in the center of the stroma. And it's designed, I think it lasers the back surface of the lenticule first and then the front surface, and then a cut is made and you pull that lenticule out. So if you can see in your mind's eye, compared to the surface techniques, this is internal, and so there's less chance of haze, less chance of discomfort, and you're not disrupting the neural layer on the surface of the cornea. So this could be a game changer. So they get less discomfort, there's no flap, there's no cutting, and better corneal stability. You don't have any problems with the subbasal nerve issues and faster nerve regeneration if there is a problem. Hopefully the video will work on this one. We'll see. So here's the lenticule in the millistroma being lasered on the back surface, I think it is, first, and the front surface. And then little cuts made. And I don't know if the video is going to show or not. They had to redo this today. I apologize. And the lenticule is pulled out with the forceps. So you get the idea. Now it comes. And that's it. So it's an ingenious thing. So would you do this in kids? Everybody, most of my colleagues would say, are you out of your freaking mind? But Larry Teichs in St. Louis did just that. He presented this at the APOS meeting in Vancouver in 2016, so we're talking 3 years ago. And he presented that time 25 children, anywhere from minus 5 to minus 10, difference between the two eyes, and got excellent visual results. No complications, safe and accurate, and the kids continue to do well, and he's continuing to laser with this technique. Worldwide, same findings. Dr. in Alexandria, Dr. Ibrahim in Egypt, I haven't seen the formal publication yet, but it was shown in one of the quick throwaway journals. 32 eyes, age 6 to 12, with myopic anisometropia, up to 14 diopters, and up to 3 diopters of astigmatism, and got 89% within half diopter target with excellent uncorrected visual acuity, and their amblyopia then reversed. So people are doing this and getting good results. So all of a sudden, with these things, we started lasering with the PRK and then the EK technique back in 1998. And you can see, you can read this for yourself, but this is what it expanded to. Kids with different types of nystagmus problems. The advantage in various forms of nystagmus is that the problem with glasses is that if your eye is jiggling, you're not getting the optimum power through the glasses. And a lot of these kids won't wear contacts if they do, great, because they will see better. And I think the laser eliminates the refractive error from the equation, plus it has a magnification effect, so they see better. And that will in turn dampen the nystagmus down, and they see better because of that. So all these entities that induce nystagmus, it can have a double whammy effect in terms of their ability to see. And one of the big ones you can see down at the bottom there, oculocutaneous albinism, very common to have high refractive error. A lot of nystagmus, and it's a problem not just from the eye, but all the way back. They've got big refractive errors associated with it. So this is a paper we published in 2011 with a series of kids, and this is just one example. Both eyes, minus 9, big cylinder, a lot of nystagmus, and glasses were not tolerated. Laser targeting about plus 2, and where we couldn't get a vision at all of a sudden, boom, the vision came up to 2200. We put a number of older kids that are 16, 17, a fair number, interestingly, from Nigeria with albinism that didn't see well enough at their age of 16 to 17 to drive. And I can think of 3 or 4 kids right off the top of my head where we lasered to eliminate the refractive error, and all of them, their vision went from like 2100 down to 2060, and then we straightened their eyes surgically because they allowed them off strabismus, and everybody got some fusion, and most of them got a driver's license after that. So there's a lot we can do now. And still, you'll hear people say, well, can't really do much for albinism. Another way to tackle this, there's more than one way to skin a cat. In Europe, instead of lasering for high refractive errors, they would use these artisan lenses. And this is an iris clip lens designed to hold down the iris, but not to damage it. They're approved in North America now. And Vanderpoel and Wurst published a paper in 1997 looking at this with a child that was aphakic, and they published 3 pediatric eyes and found that it was very successful. There's a doctor that I'll show in this slide, Johan de Faber from Rotterdam, who's got 25 to 30 years of experience with these types of lenses. And he came to a meeting in Canada a couple of years ago, and his opening line was, I don't understand you North Americans, because we've been using these lenses for 25 years and they work. It might be time to consider them. So that was his comment. And all with great results. And the one thing is that the anterior chamber has to be deep enough so that the lens doesn't rub on the back surface of the cornea. Because that's where you can get potential corneal decompensation. They're safe and effective, and there's a large number of papers now. And even in North America, there's a foldable form, which means you can get it through a small incision. And it comes both in a foldable and toric forms as well, so you can correct large astigmatic refractive errors as well. So are these being used? Well, this is a paper from Holland looking at this fairly recently, and these are the types of macular problems you deal with. And albinism is a complex thing because they have high refractive errors generally. Most times they've got macular hypoplasia, which is going to limit the results. And it seems that to wire us up properly, we have to have a certain amount of pigment to do that. And so the signal gets garbled from the front of the eye right to the back. You know, and as we're seeing at the front, processing at the back, it's a long pathway. And the signal gets garbled and garbled as it goes back. So if you can do something to eliminate the refractive error, again, it'll magnify the image and it decreases the nystagmus, and they see better because of that. So sometimes their vision will improve significantly. And even if it doesn't improve centrally, because their peripheral vision is now better, they usually dampen the nystagmus down and improve from that. So these are the three cases that she published, and all doing very well. And you can see various forms of albinism there with transillumination defects in the iris, etc. This is from a doctor in Dublin looking at a child with congenital high myopia, much like that child I showed you that was minus 23. So instead of lasering, they used artisan lenses. And you can see that he's doing just fine with them, and they get great results in Europe. Another thing that could be considered, and again, this would be considered heresy. Until recently, there was like one paper actually from Southern California using ICL. So the lens is put in the posterior chamber between the iris and the lens. Maybe potential for issues, maybe not. You know, the difficulty is the eyes are growing, and it's possible that thing's going to shift, cause a cataract, cause inflammation on the iris. Nobody knows for sure long term, but the beauty of these lenses is that they can be removed and replaced. They've been used in the adult world for high myopia and astigmatism with pretty good results overall. Is it safe in children? Well, just recently, last December, in the Canadian Journal of Ophthalmology, they did just that. They compared the ICLs, the posterior chamber lenses, to the smile technique that I showed you. And this would really be considered heresy. So I'm impressed they even got it published. But there was 15 ICL implants, 15 smile lasers. And you can see they're reading that in both groups, the vision improved, the stereopsis improved. And you can see the stereo improved significantly, 90%. So they do work. Now, in the pediatric cataract world, and you get this in adults too, you can get a refractive surprise. It's difficult in children sometimes to get accurate results because you sometimes, many times, have to put them to sleep, do the calculations intraoperatively, preoperatively, to do the surgery at the same time. And you can still get some big surprises because the eyes can potentially grow in ways that you don't anticipate. And there's a lot of research that shows that an aphakic eye is going to shift probably the most, although people argue about this in meetings all the time, an eye that does not have a lens, which again is another nail in the coffin of leaving a child aphakic. That's another whole topic. But it seems that pseudophakic eyes seem to shift, have a myopic shift that's less than an aphakic eye. And there's lots of theories about that, but nobody really understands it for sure. But the bottom line on this, what they call myopic shift, is that the children are growing and their eyes are growing. And so that eye, because it's getting bigger, is potentially becoming more myopic. So that's what we mean by a myopic shift. And you can get some big surprises sometimes. You get them bang on perfect for what you want. And say it's targeted plus two. You get plus two initially, and then as the eye grows, you end up with a big refractive surprise, which could potentially, in a monocular situation, induce a huge amount of amblyopia, as we already discussed. So then you got options. You could laser if need be. There's a lens that's put out by Rayner, which was sort of the original IOL company out of England, that is designed to be placed in the sulcus. So in this situation, this lens, it's fairly wide. It has these undulated haptics, so it's designed to fit in the posterior chamber up against the in the sulcus between the iris and the lens that's placed in the back, rather than taking that lens out and putting a new one in. It's one thing to do a lens exchange in a kid, it's quite another to actually do it, because there's a lot of scarring and potential for surgical disasters. So this lens is designed to piggyback in over top. The other clever design feature is that it's vaulted here so that it doesn't rub against the other lens, which is designed to be more in the back, so there's less chance of inflammation or membranes between the two lenses. And they're awesome lenses. So here's an example of a young lady that at 8 weeks of age had a PFV or PHPV cataracts, so the eyes tend to be small, and sometimes they'll have a vessel, a rudimentary vessel that goes from the back of the lens to the optic nerve. And these traditionally have been considered eyes that are hopeless because, one, they won't do well visually, and two, they all get glaucoma. And it seems that if you put an intraocular lens in these children, it somehow stabilizes the eye. And I don't think it's a comment on us as great surgeons, but something to do with the intraocular lens, I think, stabilizes the angle so that they don't get glaucoma. So that's a big leap forward. There's other theories about why that happens too. So here's her case. So the right eye, there was no view because of the cataract. Pretty normal power in the non-cataractous, non-PFE left eye. So ametropia would calculate that we need a 37 diopter intraocular lens, so we implanted a 29, aiming for plus 8. And people argue about this too. But in young kids, the eyes are growing fast and seem to get away with it. It seems to work better than aiming for closer to plano, because we are going to get that myopic shift. And it's going to be more so in a pseudophakic eye than a phakic eye. Well, it went the other way. She, out of the blue, she over 3 years, she had a 15 diopter myopic shift, so now she's gone the other way. She's minus 7 or minus 8. So still, there's this huge induced potential amblyogenic situation. And her vision wasn't improving, so in 2010, instead of lasering or taking that lens out with its, all of its potential complications, piggybacked in a minus 10 monofocal Rayner lens. And here she is just in August, she rolled in. She's plus a half in that eye. And what's interesting about this picture is that you can see this kind of, these two shadows here. So this is the lens that's in the bag, and this is the Rayner, the lens that's in front of it, and this vaulted area in between. So she's done very well. And her vision improved to about 20/80, which for PFV eyes is good. And she got some fusion out of it, so it's now a very useful eye. So that's another way that you can tackle these problems. Another way that works quite well, and this is done fairly commonly in Europe, is clear lens extraction. And the one situation, if we drop down to the bottom of the slide, is that this works really well in children with retinopathy of prematurity, where they've had laser for the retinopathy. The retina's already tacked down. The biggest potential complication would be retinal tears or detachments, because a lot of these kids now, if they're aphakic or pseudophakic, may be more prone to retinal tears and detachments. But if it's already tacked down, the odds of that happening is pretty slim to none. And these kids with ROP tend to be extremely myopic and very anisometropic in many cases. You get kids that are minus 14, minus 16, lots of cylinder, big difference between the two eyes. So, if you've got a situation where there's a shallow chamber, you can't potentially put an artisan lens in, you can consider the beauty of this too is that in older kids, we could put a multifocal lens in. So you take the clear lens out in both eyes, so you're treating the eyes like a cataract surgery, and implant a new lens. And in older children, the improvements in multifocal IOLs lends itself well, because older kids aren't going to want to wear reading glasses if they can avoid it, especially if they're into a lot of sports. So it really adds a lot to what we can do. And it does work like a charm, especially in these kids that have been lasered before. So this is one way to think of the refractive options in children, is that in the range from about minus, from plano to minus 15 and plano to plus 15, you could consider some sort of laser technique. Anything over that, the Europeans would use artisan lenses or a combination of treatments. And I really think that the beauty too is that you can use them not just in isolated fashions, but in combination. So refractive surgery in children has really come of age. It's a portfolio now of safe and effective techniques. And there's now really significant amounts of research globally that shows that it's safe and very effective. And everybody around the globe is finding the same results. There's probably more than 200 papers with everybody getting the same results on various techniques. And the modalities, as I mentioned, can be used individually or in combination based on their need, which is great. So it's evidence-based research out there now that shows that this works. These modalities are affordable in almost all situations, unlike some of the retina stuff, but that's amazing too. And we now have close to 30 years of research and evidence to show that this stuff works. So I show this at every talk I give, but the time to consider pediatric refractive surgery as a mainstream therapeutic option is now, not 10 years from now, but right now, because it's been out for 25 years. It works. It really works. Tell that to my other colleagues. And I'd like to close with, innovation is the ability to see change as an opportunity and not as a threat, which is, I hope, the theme of the whole afternoon. Thank you.